Welcome to Ham Radio. We are here at the KBXC studio in Bemidji. I'm Amy Thielen.
I'm Heidi Holton.
We are your hosts for Ham Radio. This week's theme is risky business. Adventures in the kitchen with lye, pickling lime, Hawaiian kalo, and some other semi-hazardous ingredients that, since the beginning of cooking time, we've been using to turn humble raw materials into unforgettable delicacies.
So thank you for joining us, and stick around. You're going to meet our guests, Wally Everson, Leanne Wong, and Megan Hanke. They'll be dropping some recipes and techniques that are dangerously delicious. You know how I like
it. Ingredients don't get any more humble than air-dried codfish, which our first guest, 87-year-old Wally Everson, has been using to make his own lutefisk from scratch in his garage for over 30 years.
And this is not the lutefisk that we all know and love, hate. So both of my grandmas made lutefisks. Then the stuff that was in the grocery store, that dried cod, rehydrated in a bath of lye and water for 14 days, boiled, buttered heavily, and jokingly served for Christmas, if you're Scandinavian, of course.
Lutefisk is the price you pay to eat the meatballs at a Norwegian Lutheran church lutefisk and meatball dinner.
It is the creepy cod. It's brought back from the dead, Amy.
Have you been to the lutefisk dinner at the Lutheran church here in Bemidji?
I have not.
Okay, so they park an empty semi-truck trailer next to the church, and they boil the lutefisk right in that.
Uh-huh.
And that's so they don't, the smell doesn't fog up the church.
Okay, sure. Lutefisk, that's the thing. It's kind of the butt of jokes, isn't it? But mm-hmm. There's sort of these inside jokes. Like in my family, my grandma Ina hated lutefisk. She was Finnish. She hated the smell and the jello, but she made it for Grampy anyway because he was Norwegian. Mm. That's true Scandinavian love right there. Amy, okay, we need to talk, all right? You made lutefisk from scratch this year.
Uh-huh.
You told me that. I didn't even know what you were talking about. What is it like?
Well, in the lutefisk tradition, it started as a joke, but then I did it, and it was kind of amazing. It wasn't even very jello-like, which is the lutefisk that I've known. It looked and tasted basically just like fresh cod, like super fresh cod, because I'd been purging it in fresh water for 14 days. It was pretty miraculous, actually.
So this sounds like science. What does the lye actually do here?
It is science. It's old science. So lye is sodium hydroxide. It's pure alkaline, pure base. It's the opposite of acid. Originally, they used to make lye from wood ashes by leaching, you know, boiling wood ashes and leaching out all of that. Just pure lye. Anything that lye touches, it softens and makes it swell up. So I don't really know much more beyond that about the chemistry, I'll be honest. But soaking the dry cod in diluted lye water plumps the cod back up to its original form. And that dried cod or stockfish that you start with, that you get from Norway, it's really, really dry. I mean, it's flat as a pancake. It looks like jerky or rawhide, you know. When I first talked to Wally, he joked, "You could shingle your roof with it, just really crooked." But I really don't think that the fish would rehydrate all the way without the lye.
All right. Well, I think we need to go straight to the source. Can we get Wally on the horn? Are you okay with that?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Hello.
How are you?
Pretty darn good.
Great. Did I catch you at okay time?
Well, I'm just sitting here doing nothing.
Great. Do you want to talk to me about lutefisk?
Yeah. What do you know about it?
Well, all I know I learned from you. We'll say that.
That could be bad.
It's good. So, Wally, you and I met. Your name came up when I was buying my dried lutefisk slabs or stockfish from Olson Fish Company in Minneapolis.
From Brian, more than likely.
Yeah, I think so. I was asking him a lot of questions, maybe too many questions, and he just finally said, "You know who you need to talk to is Wally. in Wisconsin. So how long have you been making lutefisk?
I'm not too sure. I suppose it's been at least 30 years.
Wow. How much do you think you make a year?
Well, it's kind of dried off. I have been up over 500 pounds.
Really? That's finished?
Yeah, but a lot of my lutefisk eaters are getting old and have passed on. Last year, I think I only maybe made 200 pounds.
You need new recruits.
Well, I'm running out of good lutefisk eaters.
Yeah.
Something has got to be in their genes, too.
Yeah, so tell me about your relationship with lutefisk.
When I was young, we used to have it every year at Christmas. I had five brothers, and we had lutefisk every year at Christmas. We didn't have it any other time, and they generally bought it ready-made.
Oh.
See, that was back in the 40s. I'm 87 years old.
Your family was Norwegian-American?
My great-grandfather come from Norway, over on the Swedish border. My wife was a real Norwegian. She had two grandmothers that both come from Norway.
Oh, wow.
She's the one that got me making lutefisk.
Yeah, so tell me about the first time that you started making it yourself.
When I started making it, it was kind of a trial and error. I don't know, because all I had was this recipe, and it didn't really say too much what amount you're supposed to do of anything, but it always turned out pretty decent.
When you and your wife were having your Christmases together in the beginning and you were still buying it from the store, so what caused you to make your own?
Well, we had a couple of bad experiences. She really liked this. She'd eat it 2-3 times a week until probably into March. And then, I don't know, when the weather warmed up, it didn't taste good anymore.
Okay.
I don't know, do you have lutefisk dinners in churches out there?
Oh, yes, we do.
They have them around here, too. And the reason I got into making lutefisk, because we went to one of those, and I suppose there's maybe 8, 10, 12 people sitting by the table. And the lutefisk, they would start at the head of the table, and my wife was sitting by the wall. And by the time the plate got down to her, it was empty. And they brought some more, and it was empty again. Kind of made us think about making some of our own, and she'd get all she wanted.
Oh, that's so sweet. What was your wife's name?
Gloria.
Gloria
Tennyson was her last name.
She's no longer with you?
No, I lost her. It was in 2019. Oh. She had a blood clot that went to the brain, and there's nothing. All we could do was sit in the hospital and watch her die.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess it's better than going at the nursing home, from what I see.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So, tell me about your recipe.
It works real good. First of all, you got to soak it.
Okay, so when it comes in your door, what do you do with it?
I've got a big cooler.
Okay.
I've fixed as many as 20 sticks at a time. And if you've got 1 pound of dried cod, that'll give you between 10 and 12 pounds of ready-to-eat lutefisk.
It's a crazy return. It is.
Yeah, it really takes on water.
Honestly, I was amazed to see this happen. It was like it came to life.
Yeah, yeah.
It was weird.
But there's another book that I was telling you about a little while ago. They must fix it different because they said when it was done, it was just like jello.
Well, that's the difference. See, now, I followed your recipe this year. It did not have that jello, that characteristic lutefisk jello texture. You know, when it came out of the lye, it was a little bit like that on the surface, but it was so much firmer, and it was so wonderful, actually. It was a lot like fresh cod.
Yeah, it's like batter-fried cod when using my recipe. But if you overcook it, that's when it turns to mush.
Yeah, or maybe when they add too much lye. I don't know.
Well,
so,
yeah, that could be, too. That will make a difference because it'll take on water too fast.
Can you walk us through the recipe, like, in a quick way?
Soak it in water for a week, changing water on it every day. And then I put 1 heaping teaspoon on for each side of fish. That would be about 1/2 pound of fish.
1 heaping teaspoon of lye, food grade lye.
1 heaping teaspoon, and then just add a little bit more. And then I leave that in there for 4 days, keeping it cold. I always have some milk jars that I keep frozen.
Oh, and that's how you keep it submerged?
That's how I keep it. I put plenty of water on and just leave that in there, and the temperature runs around 45 degrees in there for that whole period.
Oh, you've got ice jugs in there. That's how you're doing it.
Yeah, and I change that every day. That's really smart. Put in a fresh jug. And you know, that stuff is so hard, you can't cut it with a scissor or a knife.
You mean the dried cod? I know. Oh, believe me, I went through that. Yeah. So do you cut it, or do you leave it whole?
What I do, I always throw it in the cooler whole, even if it doesn't fit, and leave it overnight. Then I can cut it any way I want, even with a scissor.
Wow, I wish I'd talked to you first about that. Okay.
Yeah. I've even used the tin snips on it, and you can't hardly cut it.
I tried the tin snips. They didn't work. We had to use long-handled tree loppers.
Yeah, well, my son, he monkeys with it a little bit, too, and then he always uses a saw. We've got a bandsaw up in the shed.
Okay.
So it smells like lutefisk up in the shed, too.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was making this and you gave me your recipe, I had to call you a few times because I was really unsure about different parts of the process. And especially once I had the lutefisk brine, the lye brine in the, on the fish, that's when the thing is really working and the lye is really going to work, and it's, you're seeing it swell every day and it's reconstituting. But that's the part where I just wanted to make sure that I didn't underdo it or overdo it. So what's your advice for that?
Make sure that it's completely covered with water and you won't overdo it if you don't put too much lye on it.
Okay.
And then after about 4 days, drain the lye solution off and start adding cold water to it and drain it every day. And after about 3 or 4 days, it's ready to eat. But it takes about 2 weeks, the whole process.
So who are you making all this for? Where does it go?
Well, I've got, there's a lot of friends and relatives that like it. And there's 1 year that I made so much of it, the Legion up here in Black River Falls, they had a lutefisk feed, and they took 165 pounds of it that one day.
So locally, you're known as the artisan.
Yeah. Lutefisk man.
Yeah. That's awesome. You probably give some away, too.
Oh, yes. I give, well, I got some brothers and stuff that I give it away, yeah. Because some of them like it and some of them don't, but most of my brothers, they do like lutefisk. But one spoonful goes quite a ways for me.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not a big lutefisk eater.
Oh, you're kidding me. I would never have guessed that. But your wife, so.
Oh, yeah, she really likes it.
Oh, that's very sweet.
And then we bought some lutefisk 1 year. That's when we really decided to start making it our own down here at the local grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And we took it home and cooked it, and it turned to that mushy stuff. And she couldn't eat it. So that's when I really got serious about making our own.
Oh, that's so sweet. So you had to take on a project.
Yeah, take it on from scratch. But the recipe book that I got, that's from 1924. And that's the only recipe that I could get for making it was a local old lady downtown here. And it was a church. She's got that church book.
So you sent this to me, and I've been looking through it, and it's one of the greatest community church cookbooks I've ever seen.
Yeah,
you know,
it is. It is. Nice, there's only some things in there that I'm a little concerned about.
What's you that?
Know, when you're making something, it says, you're supposed to put cinnamon in it or ginger or something, but it doesn't say how much. But I think those old-time ladies, they knew what to do. They'd use just their fingers and put a pinch of it in.
Yeah, they did. They did know. You know, it's kind of silly, actually, the way, like, recipes are so precise today. And ingredients are different, though. They do vary. And I think that in a lot of ways, the kind of the oral tradition or passing down a story by the story of a recipe is more precise.
Recipe is just a guideline, is all it is, you know.
Right, and especially with this kind of thing, like lutefisk, it's your setup. It's the coolers in the garage. It's how you're handling it and all of that stuff. So what do your neighbors think? I mean, does it smell in your garage, or is that just kind of, is the smell kind of a myth?
The kids can smell it in the garage, but my sniffer isn't working very good anymore. So I don't.
Yeah, and why do you think cooking with lye is something that's kind of fallen out of fashion?
Well, I think it's people are scared of it. There's a skull and bones right on the package. It's poison.
I didn't have skull and bones on mine.
Didn't?
No. I didn't have a poison control sticker, nothing.
Oh, is that right? Well,
yeah.
I think it's Lewis lie that I got. I think that's got the crossbones and stuff on it.
That's great.
The first time I was going to make it, I was supposed to use lye, and I went to the hardware store, and he didn't have any.
Mm-hmm.
And he dug in his shelf, and he gave me some, it isn't Drano, but it was a light Drano for a sewer.
Oh, no.
He said, this is the same thing.
And so but then what?
Well, I called the company. The number was on the container, and they said, do not use it for that. It isn't a cooking grade, he said.
That's great. Yeah, that's pretty wise. All right, Wally, we have to stay in touch, and you have to tell me more about your new projects. Just give me a ring.
Sure, I'll do that.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, keep in touch.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
You are listening to Ham Radio, Cooking with Amy Thielen. Wow.
He's so funny, and he knows he's funny, too. he's kind of like a phone friend now. Do you notice how, like, after you talk to Wally for a while, it's like you can't help but say it the way that he says it? And I started saying, like, lutefisk, and then I'm like, lutefisk.
I know. It changes. I've been saying that to my friends, too, as I talk to them, because it's like, Wally says it that way, I got to say lutefisk now.
You know, it feels wrong otherwise.
Yeah. So, what you made this lutefisk over the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
How was the family with it?
You know what was funny about it? It was that it was great. It was this great experiment and everything, but it almost wasn't weird enough for the Norwegian-Americans at my table.
Do they think it's weird, or you're meaning it?
Well, I think that, you know, it is kind of an inside joke,
right?
As
right.
we were saying. So part of the thing about it is that, you know, you're eating this old poverty food of the homeland that Norwegians in Norway pretty much don't eat very much anymore. But the Norwegian-Americans do, and it's smelly, it's stinky, it's got, you know, this texture that's very bouncy and gelatinous. And the from scratch stuff was like a more pure product. I mean, it was really nice. It was like codfish. So it didn't have, I guess, that joke factor, you know. Next year, maybe I'm just going to add more lye.
Well, coming up, we've got lots more ahead, and we are learning more about some of these things that are sort of kind of risky to try a little bit in our kitchens. So that's coming up, and we'll open up our phone lines and the text line. But right now, we're going to hear more Northern Minnesota recipes. This time, we are hearing from a forager.
Hi, you're on Ham Radio. Who am I talking to?
Francesca Squadroni.
Hi, Francesca. What do you want to talk about?
Acorn flour.
Interesting. Have you made that?
Yes.
I've heard this is a really long, involved process of making acorn flour. Tell me all about it.
Well, first you gather white oak acorns because they're bigger and they have less tannins, which aren't super good for you if you eat too many.
The tannins in the acorns. Okay.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to gather any that don't have caps on them or have holes in the side. They need to be like the perfect solid brown. And then you fill up a bucket of water and you put them in. And the ones that float means that they have like something that ate into it and you need to throw them out. And then you let those dry. And then you crack them open with a nutcracker. Sometimes there's actually like a worm in there.
Okay.
You just need to throw those away. And then we grind them into small, but not like flour yet. And then, so you get two pots of water, and then you let those boil. and then you put all the acorns in one pot. And once it gets to a dark brown, you transfer the acorns into the other pot, and then you dump out the boiling water, and then you refill, and then you boil again. And then you just want to keep doing that until the water doesn't get brown anymore, and it just stays clear.
Do you add anything to the water? That sounds like you're leaching out the tannins in the acorn.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it. And then
cool.
You can either like dehydrate them or dry them in the sun. And then what we do is we use our Vitamix and then we ground it into flour. And then there's your flour for whatever you want to use it in.
So you're basically like competing with squirrels for all of these acorns?
Kind of. But like
so what do you use the acorn flour for?
We make acorn pancakes that taste pretty good.
Yeah, so what do they taste like?
They kind of taste like normal pancakes, but like, I don't really know how to explain it. It's like a weird flavor, but it's good.
It's part of the appeal of it that if something goes wrong, you're going to, you know, it's a little bit dangerous. Is it kind of thrilling?
Yeah. One time we left them in a couple days before doing the water process, and we had worms all over because there was still a bunch in the acorns. So then we had like a bunch of little worm larvae like crawling around our house.
So yeah, you're kind of taking over the kitchen with all these pots of boiling acorns.
Yeah.
What does the house smell like? Does it smell pretty good?
Last year it smelled not good. It wasn't a good smell.
So you walk in and you're like, must be boiling acorns in here. That kind of thing?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. I can see for you, you probably have more interesting, unusual cooking projects in your future. What else do you like to make?
I like to make omelet for breakfast. And then I also like to make fried eggs or scrambled eggs.
Great. How do you like your scrambled eggs?
I like to add milk with it. And then I like to cook it more because I don't. Sometimes like the eggs turn out like slimy if you don't cook them enough. And I don't really like that sliminess.
Yeah, I know. When I was a kid, I did the same thing. I think that was the first thing I ever really made was scrambled eggs and I'd cook them really hard. Exactly. Well, thanks for being on. It's been really fun talking to you about your acorn flour.
Thanks.
Okay, was that like little Amy Thielen there? I feel like she was doing a similar process that you did with the lutefisk and the lye, like pots and thyme and all of this stuff.
She likes the process. I was so impressed with her dedication to this. I mean, it must take days. You know, so acorn flour, I've maybe tried it once. It's kind of a rare thing because obviously it takes so many acorns and so much time. But, you know, if you were to not go through that process of leaching it out, the tannins, you know, it hurts your stomach. So,
okay.
Yeah.
It's an important
cool.
process there.
Yeah. I think it tastes a little bit like buckwheat flour, real earthy, you know.
Okay.
What a cool kid.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm thinking of all the larvae running around in her house there from the worms. So later in the show, we're going to hear from you. You can call us or text us, 218-326-1234. I am Heidi Holton, and this is Ham Radio Cooking with Amy Thielen. So Amy, I'm excited. Our next guest is a chef, and she's an author, Leanne Wong. She's of Top Chef and Iron Chef and of fame on the Food Network. She's the author of Dumplings All Day, and she lives on Maui, where she has a restaurant called Cocoa Head Cafe, and sadly, she lost another one in the Lahaina fire. But Amy, you knew her way back when, didn't you?
Yeah, we cooked together at 66, which was John George von Gerichten's Chinese restaurant in New York City, in Tribeca. And she and I both worked the hot appetizer station. We put out shrimp toast, scallion pancakes, hot and sour soup, and we made this one particular dish called fried lotus seed crab. And it was a stuffed blue crab that was stuffed with like the crab meat, kind of like with mayo. And then it was covered with a really cool dough, which was made with steamed lotus seeds that we pureed and ammonium bicarbonate.
Oh my.
Yeah. And then we deep fried it. And so what happened then is that the dough puffed up and just beautifully into this really light, lacy crust. And it's kind of like the taro puffs, if you ever have had those at a dim sum restaurant. But that's why I wanted to talk to her. I know that we used to add ammonium bicarbonate to that dough,
And that is an alkaline-like lye, but it's a leavening agent. So it's kind of like baking soda on steroids. But honestly, the details about the rest of it are kind of a blur.
All right. Well, let's get Leanne.
First of all, thank you so much for joining us here. It's been about 20 years since you and I last talked. And when we did, we were working together, the same mm-hmm. station. Was one of us morning and one at night? Was that how it was?
I was in morning. You worked evening service. Yeah. And then I left to do the events and continuing at French Culinary, like right after we got reviewed. And Josh was like, "You're making a mistake." And I was like, "Eh." And it was honestly one of like the best decisions I ever made.
I mean, you did leave me, though. I remember feeling that. I was like, "Don't leave me." Leanne.
Yeah. That was such a crazy, crazy restaurant. And it was like, yeah, we do like 400 covers for lunch, another 600 for dinner. I would just make scallion pancakes like all day. It was just that dim sum station was just like bananas. I remember all the Prada shoes. It was all the cooks that would save up their pennies for Prada shoes.
Who was buying Prada shoes?
Like all the cooks, all the boys were like saving their pennies so they could wear Prada shoes like JG. It was like a total thing.
They were really fly. And I remember not looking very fly myself.
Different times.
I mean, we were worked hard. We worked hard there because it was the very beginning run of that place.
Literally, the dim sum chefs were the highest paid cooks in the kitchen. They'd come in 4 days a week. I had to make all their fillings for them. So it's like they didn't even make their own fillings. They just would like stamp out dumplings and Peking duck pancakes, smoke cigarettes in the spare unfinished basement rooms. Like, it was just like, I mean, those were the days. It was
they were kind of like the princes, man. They kind of.
I mean, it was a very eye-opening experience for me because, like, I love dim sum, and I have this one place that I worship in Honolulu that I've been going to for almost 20 years. When I moved to Maui, which is a bit of a food desert, at least it's definitely an Asian food desert, people are like, "Oh, you should open a dim sum restaurant." I'm like, "Oh, are you gonna come every day and spend your money with me every day?" I could and I would. "Oh, do you think you could find me 20 uncles and aunties that would like to make dim sum for me all day?" Like, it's just like, you know, just really like thinking about the labor that goes into it. Like, Chinese food dim sum should not be considered cheap food. If anything, it's so labor intensive. It's like, I would gladly pay more for this. So
it pays better attention to how they made all of those and formed all the dumplings.
Yeah, I have a dumpling cookbook now. I like teach dumpling classes. I do dumpling demonstrations for money.
Some of them were kind of intricate, though. They were like hard to make.
Literally, you can put anything in a dumpling wrapper and like A, people will eat it, and B, usually it's going to be pretty good.
We started about the same time, and it was, you know, right after they had opened.
One of the cooks, Wong, he used to chase me around with chicken feet. I remember that. But like, it was a good education because it was such a different experience from Aquavit.
Remind me where else you had worked.
So I worked at Aquavit for like 2.5 years. I did a very short stint as a private chef for a Fortune 500 family. And then I started at 66. I was there for opening and then we got reviewed and then I left to go to French Culinary. And during that time, I was cast on the first season of Top Chef.
I remember hearing that you were on TV and I wasn't surprised, you know, because it's like you have such a magnetic personality, and you do, you're like really outgoing and
Thank
fun
you.
And you're funny, and so
it was an interesting thing.
First Top Chef that you were on, it was like the first.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, there were 12 of us, and we came from like all walks of life, home cooks, culinary students, I'm just a mom and I like food, to professional chefs. Really interesting social experiment. I did a video audition and it like kind of fell off my brain for like the summer, and then suddenly I got a call back saying like, "Hey, you've been chosen as a potentially a contestant, you know, we're gonna fly you out for a final interview to LA they put us up some hotel by the airport, and we had to sign this really, really long contract, and it's like for NBC Bravo, and like, you read it and it says like, you know, we can put hidden cameras anywhere, you know, you're not gonna sue us if you jump out of a plane and injure yourself, like just all this, the reality TV writer, right? So I get into my hotel room and I am like paranoid and I'm like climbing the furniture because I'm like, is there like a hidden camera in this room, you know? And of course there wasn't, wow. But it's so funny because like, you know, they make you take a psych test and it's seriously? Just like three. Yeah, it's like 300 like true false questions. Like, I love my mom. I like to read books. I like long walks. The moon is made of cheese. Somebody's watching me. So they want to find out if you're like secretly like an emotional basket case before they put you on TV and put you in a high pressure situation. When I came to produce the show a year later, I was very much involved in the casting process. And I know friends who did not pass the psych test.
I just kind of want to get back to why really I wanted to invite you on for this show where we're talking to also this guy, Wally Everson from Wisconsin, who's making lutefisk by hand.
Oh, gosh.
And I just started thinking about, like, lye, and why are we afraid of it when really it's just baking soda on steroids? And that led me back to a lot of memories cooking with you at 66, making this crab. It was like a blue crab. We took the tops off and we stuffed all the meat picked out of the bones back into the body with like a spicy mayo. And then we covered it with this lotus seed paste dough.
It had the ammonium bicarbonate in it.
You remember, I had a real hard time. I was struggling to make this thing work and puff. They were breathing down my neck, all those guys. And I was like, oh, and then you could come in and you struggled a bit too, but then you were starting to like knock it out of the park. But
it's like we had to make it with a lotus seed paste and use cooked lotus seeds. And so everything to me was about the moisture content in the lotus seeds that ended up making the difference in the puff and the evaporation. The end result was you wanted this dough kind of like stalagmites out of like the shell. Yeah.
Almost like a porous rock sort of look to it, like a honeycomb or something.
Yep.
It was a really light dough. And that had to come, I think, from that ammonium bicarbonate.
I read up on it after I knew we had to use it. And it's like a leavening agent, like anything else, in very small amounts. It's food safe. The fact that we were cooking it at such a high temperature, any ammonia left over would evaporate in the cooking process, odor-wise and flavor-wise. And yeah, I remember having to like go into like the dry storage closet and the bucket was like on the floor. And
yeah,
you open the lid and you like go and get like a teaspoon of this stuff and you're just like, oh my God, I'm going to pass out.
No, I remember the smell too.
It's not a pleasant smell.
You're listening to Ham Radio on KAXE.
Two nights ago, I made Siberian pelmeni. For some weird reason, I've been like, it was really cold here.
The hexagon mold?
Yeah, Aaron got me the hexagon mold. But the thing is that it doesn't leave enough room. To use the hexagon mold, you have to use less than a dime's worth of filling. And I was like, I don't know the patience for this. So I just, I used my cutter. I don't know. It isn't.
Yeah, I love that mold. I think the key is having enough flexibility in your dough that you can really kind of make a deep indentation and you can fill a full heaping teaspoon in there, you know?
It's like, poke it through.
I like to use sometimes I'll use like a hot water dough that denatures the gluten.
Yeah.
So you can roll it and the dough's really flexible. And then you can use like a piping bag, pipe a full on teaspoon in. Yeah. And then you roll that top layer and just rolling pin that guy. But I love the pelmeni maker because it's like, look, I've made 27 perfect little dumplings all at once, you know?
Well, I'm just like putting on the TV in my kitchen and I'm just like zoning out, you know, making them. But I hear you. The dough is softer and the one I've been using, it has water in it. So it is stretchier. I didn't think to use the hot water though.
Hot water will denature the gluten, you know? So it's a great dumpling dough. It's like once it comes together, give it, you know, 15, 20 minutes resting time, or you can use a vac machine and kind of like speed up the resting process and then roll it out. I love it.
I'm just curious, what are some of the cool things you're making? Like,
so my restaurants are super local. We focus on a lot of local ingredients and how we can utilize that in our everyday specials and menu items. So, you know, when you talk about lutefisk, one of the most important foods in Hawaiian culture is kalo. We have a number, over a dozen canoe crops, which are basically crops that were brought via the ocean from other places like Guam, any of the Pacific Islands, the Canary Islands, et cetera, et cetera. So these canoe crops became very important foods for the cultures that settled here, the main Hawaiian cultures, Native Hawaiians. And so you have things like uwala, which is sweet potato, and ulu, which is breadfruit, and kalo, which is taro root. When we talk about Hawaiian culture and we talk about, I guess, ancient storytelling, there is the story of Haloa, and it is about the relationship between man and the earth and food and Mother Nature, right? And it's basically these two Hawaiian gods have a child, and the child dies. So they basically have another child. This child is a human, and the human basically takes his dead brother and plants him in the ground, and this becomes the first kalo plant. The leaf of the kalo is shaped like a heart, for one. Basically, the stem regenerates. Basically, you know, you have the stem, you have the leaf, you have the root. Inside the center of that root is the corm, which is the white part of the taro. On the outside is the koena, which is the starchier flesh. But when you grow it, it also gets like cakey. So it gets like little baby roots, you know, like a root vegetable, right?
Oh, wow.
But basically, you can, when you harvest it, they cut the stem off. So they'll pull them, but then they'll cut the stem off and replant the stem. And it regrows. So you could be having a piece of taro root that's generations old.
Does that matter? Does it taste different?
There are dozens of varieties of kalo. There used to be over 264 varieties of taro in the Hawaiian Islands. And then at some point, I believe it was like from Samoa, but there was like a taro blight. So like there was a pest that came in, there was a taro blight. And now there's about a little over, I think like 60 varieties of kalo, edible kalo in the Hawaiian Islands. You know, versus like Chinese taro, which we're used to, which is very mild, right? The Hawaiian taro tends to have like concentrated calcium oxalate. So when you need to like cook it properly, otherwise you get like sort of like these tingles, very uncomfortable, painful tingles in your throat. So you always have to like cook the kalo. Like even if you're making chips, sometimes you fry it. If you don't cook it enough, you get like the itchies in the back of your throat and you're trying to eat taro chips.
Oh, no.
So I only use Chinese taro for like chips and stuff like that. You know, like I you have to consider what type of taro you're getting, how you're going to cook it. Pressure cooker is usually the best way to do it. But so we had a dish on our menu called Eggs Haloa. And basically it was, again, the idea that this plant, the relationship between Haloa and his brother Kalo, was that he takes care of him and Kalo continues to feed him for the rest of his life. And the things that you can make with the heart of Hawaiian culture, they'd say with kalo, is the main dish would be poi, right? And that is hand-pounded taro root with water added in. That's how you make poi. It's basically fully cooked, and then you peel the koena off. You peel the outer skin off. You peel that first starchy layer of koena, which you can dry into a flour or make cakes with or do whatever. We do a lot with it. But then you take that cooked corm, and you pound it, and traditionally it's with a pohaku stone. It's with a stone that's been formed out of volcanic rock or some sort of stone, and you basically muddle it on a board, which is a papakuiai. It's a board you pound in kalo on. And every village would have, like, boards would be set aside just for this purpose alone, because the natural bacteria would build in this board. And kalo, interesting enough, is something that has very healthy bacteria. So you can ferment it. So the form of kalo that is, that you pound like mochi, like basically into a paste, and the more you pound it, the more it forms this like almost like elasticized dough, right? This sticky sort of dough. That's called pa'iai. First of all, kalo is a hand-harvested thing. It's not something that you can harvest with a machine. So that's very labor-intensive to grow and harvest it, it's especially wetland taro. Factory poi, like when the industrial age came to Hawaii, they started making poi in factories where it's cut with a blade. So like, of course you can take taro and put it in a roboku and turn it into puree, smashing the molecules and creating these new strands, right? And so pa'iai, you could basically, they'd wrap it in tea leaf and take it with them on long journeys. Now, you can leave this stuff on your counter for 30 days at room temperature. And it's, you know, it's like average temperature here, 75, 79 degrees on any given day. And it'll naturally form this like mold on the outside, but it's fermenting. And so you can actually cut that moldy piece off, re-steam it, and you can taste it, the natural fermentation in it. But the pot EI is crazy because it's like, because of its cool texture, mochi-like texture, you can treat it once it chills down, you can treat it like a cake, and you can like pan fry it, deep fry it, bake it, roast it. It turns, it's like crispy on the outside and gooey on the inside. There's like nothing that can imitate this texture, you know, from a vegetable.
Freaking fascinating.
This is ancient food science, which is what we're talking about. You know, the Hawaiians had figured this out years ago, and actually kalo production and the making of poi in the ancient Hawaiian way was illegal for many, many years in the state of Hawaii. I think it's because the health department wasn't up to date with the actual HACCP plan of the chemistry and science behind natural fermentation with a product in how it's harvested, processed, and made. So it's like, oh, it has to be in a commercial facility, this, that, and the other. But I think it was over 10 years ago, there was advocacy in the community to legalize pot EI again, which it has been. So pot EI can now be made in approved facilities, which whether that's outdoor or indoor, and it can be sold commercially. So it's more expensive than meat. It's like, I mean, minimum is like 18, 20 bucks a pound because you're looking at labor at the same time. People don't realize that it's gold. You can take 1 pound of pot EI and make 5 pounds of poi just by adding water. So you can feed a family. And that's really what it was about, was that here's this food that's like contractible, expandable. When you have poi with water and it's got that natural bacteria, you can keep it in like a sanitary bowl on your kitchen called an umeke and let that naturally ferment. My friend who does it, I'm always like, I want some of your sour poi, because poi will naturally start to ferment after like a day or two. So you'll start to taste that sourness. His stuff tastes like yogurt. It looks and it tastes like yogurt. And it's incredible. And it's just been like fermenting on his kitchen counter in like literally like a Rubbermaid bowl with like a plastic lid on top. So super, super cool stuff.
What I hear from you and what I see you doing in a lot of restaurateurs and people who are working in food is like you're sharing that, you're passing on that knowledge. You're passing on that touch. That's what I'm concerned always with. Like, are we going to lose the touch, the feel for this dough, or the knowledge to make the sour poi? Like, that's so important that taste continues and that hunger and that craving.
Yeah.
I mean,
again, I think it's culture, and I thankfully have an incredible team in my kitchen that stays interested. They're very young group of cooks and chefs, but they are, they're hungry and they're ambitious and they're dependable. And like, it's, you know, they're the future. Inspiring them to think bigger, I think, is always a goal, but also at the same time, making sure that they don't forget the day to day, you know, just like the little things that I'll see a picture of like one of our dishes on social media. And I'm like, who's putting the togarashi on the egg? Because I don't want a finger of togarashi on my eggs. It ruins the dish. I'll call them out. And I'm just like, less, less. It's like a cocaine line of togarashi on the egg. I'm like, stop. It's again, like, I have one kid, but I'm parent to dozens of adults. So.
Yeah. I can see that. I have one kid too. I want to hear, like, what do you feed him? I'm just curious.
I was in like Dino Nugget hell for a little bit. I still am. So he eats very basic. He doesn't like sauces or spices. But he came down home one day from like Montessori at like 5. And he's just like, I tried feeding him something. And he's like, Mama, that has too much flavor for me. And my taste buds just aren't ready for that. So no, thank you. And he said it in such a way that I was like, who gave you that lawyer written response? And he said it so politely, I couldn't like argue with him.
I'm so happy to be reconnected. All right. Well, this was like amazing. Really fun.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you.
Oh my gosh.
She's great. I learned so much in that conversation.
No kidding.
Mean, I love how we started talking about, you know, ammonium bicarbonate, but then she's talking about something that's even more interesting, possibly, which is the pahiai, the fermented poi. I really need to try this. I'm going to have to go there and try it. I mean, it sounds like it's something between like an aged cheese and meat, and there's just like so much generational knowledge in the making of something like that and in keeping it alive. And it's really cool to see her help keep it alive. And I'm not surprised whatsoever, because I know that's who she is.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
They're all, it's so interesting because it's all kind of relating here, all these projects, right? Food
yeah.
projects and things mm-hmm. and more intricate and patience and scary things. So, coming up, we've got some more strange recipes coming up, right?
Yes, we do. We've got Megan Hanke. She used to live here, and she moved back home to Kansas a few years ago. She is a fabulous chef. She's a real chef. And she makes this very unusual pickle, and it's called sweet lime pickle.
Okay, so like a lemon.
No, like it's not. That's what I thought at first too. But lime, as in pickling lime. Have you ever seen that in the
oh, yeah.
canning
yep.
aisle in the grocery store?
Yeah.
So pickling lime is again another form of baking soda, kind of one of these supercharged alkalines. And what it does is when you add your cucumbers into a solution of it, it turns them into a different texture. So we can hear her talk about that, but it's kind of like a bread and butter pickle, like a sweet pickle,
okay.
but very different.
Wow. Hey, we've also, you know, as we've been talking about ham radio, lots of people have been writing in the last week or so. We heard from Kathleen from Brainerd. She says, my cooking risk is yogurt. I finish it overnight in my oven using my oven light. Most of the time it comes out creamy and smooth. However, I've had a couple failures too. I never know until the following morning, but making yogurt is so easy, cheap, and good for the environment. No plastic containers. I've been making it for 8 years.
Oh, that's cool.
So a light is the thing that does it.
Well, it probably adds just enough heat, you know, which is kind of like the principle behind when you keep chickens in the winter, put a light bulb in the...
Or easy bake ovens, kind of,
or
right?
easy bake ovens.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, my mother and father-in-law are making yogurt now, too. And it's, you know, it's a great thing to babysit, talking about projects.
There you go. All right, let's learn about these bright green pickles that you told us about. How's that?
Yeah.
Hey, Megan, it's Amy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So, are you ready to talk about the sweet lime pickles?
I would love to talk about the sweet lime pickles.
So, when you brought those out, I was surprised because I think of you as like somebody who just like makes beautiful things from the garden and salads and soup and also breaks down hogs with me and does all that. But these pickles are from your home area of the Kansas City area. And tell me about them. Like, whose recipe is this?
This is my grandmother's recipe, my paternal grandmother's recipe, Marcella Jean. These are pickles that they've always just been around my whole life. I just remember them having just this very subtle presence. They were just always there. There's always a jar of these unnaturally green pickles in the refrigerator. I think I put that in the recipe, you know, like enough green food coloring so that they are unnaturally bright green. They've just been in our family.
But the texture is so unusual to me, aside from the radioactive color. You know, I grew up in the upper Midwest, Minnesota, northern Minnesota, and I have never seen this kind of pickle. I grew up with kind of a sweet vinegar bread and butter pickle. And so when you say that they are common and familiar to you, how would you describe the texture?
They're almost brittle, crispy, not just crunchy, but like they'd shatter almost, you know, like that's like
yeah.
when you're preparing them, like after you take them, after you soak them in the lime, we soak them for like 24 hours.
Tell me like what kind of lime, like
pickling lime. Yeah.
Which you can buy at the grocery store.
Yeah, you can buy at the grocery store. Or, you know, anywhere that you would buy canning supplies. So it's not like it's some crazy hard to find element. Yeah. But you cut the cucumbers and you soak them for a couple days in this pickling lime and water. And that is when this magic happens. You know, it's a very alkaline solution. Not as alkaline as lye to like burn your skin, but it will cause irritation. But so you take them out and you rinse them and then soak them. And then, you know, you want to really rinse all of that off. But before you put them in this super sweet syrup, like you can just snap them almost like they're going to like kind of shatter. There's that crispy, which makes them a little bit tricky to deal with getting them into the jars without breaking them up. But
yeah, like a really brittle green bean or even crisper.
Unnaturally crispy. Just a very interesting dichotomy of things going on with the crispiness of the vegetable and then the syrup, which it is. It's just thick, almost like cold honey. Like it's so, the syrup is so sweet. You process them with that and then can them. I just remember, you know, them always just sort of being around. And unfortunately, I did not come to even enjoy pickles until I was in my 20s. So I never ate them as a child. I didn't even really know what they were. They were just always there.
Well, they look weird, you know, like they're so green.
And as a kid, I didn't understand. Everybody would say sweet lime pickles. And in my mind, you know, I thought it was like the fruit, a lime, because those are green. Yeah. And I was just like, I just don't get that. But when I came to know and love pickles in my culinary journey, and then when I moved to Minnesota and really fell down the pickle rabbit hole and started making and canning and experimenting, you know, I really came to appreciate the nuance of that. And the first time I made them was actually, I think it was one of the first times my parents came to visit, and my mom and I made them together. And that was a really, really fun experience. So, you know, I had cucumbers out of the garden, and she called my aunt and got my grandmother's recipe. And we, over the course of a few days, made those together. And that was very fun. So that was my first experience making them. And I've made them several times since, and we'll definitely have to make them this year for sure.
Yeah. But thanks for the recipe. I'm going to try them too. I think they're texturally so interesting. And so traditionally, like, where would you use a sweet lime pickle like this? Is it a side thing? Is it, or does it go into something? Or
the quintessential one in my mind recipe that you would use them in is roast beef salad. And so roast beef salad, which I love.
It's a very Kansas thing, the roast beef salad.
It is. So what we would do in farm life, the meals of the day are not breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's breakfast, dinner, supper. Right. So the big meal happens, the midday meal, and
dinner is at noon. Right.
And dinner was always at noon because we didn't have cell phones. And, you know, my dad and uncle and grandpa would like dinners at noon, and you show up at noon. And oftentimes my grandmother would make pot roast because, you know, my family raised cattle. And so we would have pot roast. And again, my grandmother was of that area where things were cooked well, like really well.
You mean so, like all the way?
Like all the way and then some. And and bless her heart, she did make really good gravy because sometimes things would be a little bit dry. Mm-hmm. So we would have, you know, a lot of times we'd have roast beef for that midday family dinner. And then that roast beef would turn into roast beef salad for just your light supper.
Ham salad, but roast beef.
Yeah, it's
right?
Like, yep, ground
mixed with mayonnaise,
over, roast beef, lots of mayonnaise, sweet lime pickles, a little bit of onion, maybe mustard if you were feeling real risque. I'm not sure. I don't remember if she put mustard in it, but essentially it's onions, sweet lime pickles, roast beef, mayonnaise. Those are the staples. And that's what you would have for supper. And when we were talking about sweet lime pickles, you know, it's been kind of a fun little adventure. I had a good conversation with my parents about it, find out if anybody had like some fun special memories or things that stood out about that. I was talking to my aunt last night, my dad's older sister, and she's sort of the keeper of the recipes and sort of, you know, that lineage for our family. And so she was going through my grandmother's recipe cards and found some very other interesting recipes, but was just talking about her memories of it and how, as something that goes into a recipe, she said they went into roast beef salad, they went into ham salad, they went into tuna salad, like any sort of classic mayonnaise-based salad had sweet lime pickles. And then she said they also always had them with soup, as just like there was always just a little bowl of the sweet lime pickles on the table. I'm sure there was bread and butter because that was also a staple. And that kind of reminded me of when you took me to Bologna Days, which is still just a special place in my heart, you know, and all of the older women would bring their homemade jars of pickles in.
Yeah, in Piers. Yeah. Well, that's a road trip we have to do again.
Absolutely. I'll see you in Piers kind of a thing.
I know. Let's meet. It's not halfway between here and Kansas City, but yeah, no, you'd have definitely more driving. But it's funny that you say that you would avoid the pickles as a kid, because to me, they seem like candy looking. They look like they're in candy. They're sort of candied.
They do. And they're so sweet. They make my teeth hurt thinking about it, but they're delicious.
But it's that textural love, you know, where you snap them and they're still juicy. Do you remember that you brought those to that party that we did with Andrew Zimmern when we shot an episode of Bizarre Foods at Katie Kieber's house down the road?
Absolutely.
Her horseradish party. Everybody brought food. It was a potluck. And you brought the sweet lime pickles, which that was the first time that I'd ever seen you bring those out. Tell him what he said. Yeah.
I think he was just like, these are truly a bizarre food.
I remember it as him saying, that's the weirdest thing I've ever eaten.
Well, yeah. So, and that says a lot.
That's what I remember. That's how I remember it. I don't know. I mean, the guy is eating like all these crazy things and sweet lime pickle that brings him down, you know? Megan, thanks so much for this. This is so cool. It's so good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. It's so great to talk to you too.
Ham Radio, we have so much more to be talking about, but we'll be back next Friday and the podcast is available. What else will we be providing? Will you be providing, Amy?
Well, this week we're going to be putting out Wally's lutefisk recipe, which is, you know, worth its weight in gold. And that is maybe not so seasonal right now, but it's something you're going to want to bookmark for next winter. You know, when times are tough, make lutefisk. We're going to be putting that out, and then we're also going to be releasing the community recipe for next week, which is bran crisp bread, and that is also Scandinavian, and it comes a recipe that comes from my very dear friend Bruce Engebretsen, who will be on next week, and it also is coming from my latest cookbook, Company.
Well, and you can play along at home. Make the recipe and then let us know how it is. You can always text us 218-326-1234. Thanks for listening to Ham Radio. Ham Radio on KEXE is made possible in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Original music for the show licensed from Jeremy Messersmith. Our graphic design is by Christopher Larson with artwork by T.L. Solian. Subscribe to the Ham Radio podcast at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, or find us at kaxe.org. Ham Radio is hosted and produced by Amy Thielen and Heidi Holton. Thanks go out to Sarah Bignall, Jennifer Barr, Chelsea Perkins, Lori Shaw, Jen Kellen, and the members of KAXE.
Feels like home. It's all right. You know how I like it. It's just fine. But you know how I like it. Ooh, like sifting flour with your hands, making coffee every morning. Doesn't matter what I do, if I fall for someone new, I'll be here missing you. It's alright, but you know how I like it. It's just fine, but you know how I like it. Ooh la la la, ooh la la la. If I'm honest, it's just okay. It's just fine.